During these days, our Holy Church presents readings from the Apostle and Evangelist Luke. That is why these Sundays are called the Sundays of Luke. I do not know whether you ever read these passages yourselves, or whether you are able to follow what I'm saying. Our Christ worked a miracle near Gergesa and Gadara. He cast a legion of demons out of a suffering man. He delivered that man and let him go free. That legion entered a herd of swine, and the swine plunged into the lake and drowned. Just imagine, the people there lost about 100,000 kilos, or okades, as we used to call them, of pork. The moment Christ touched their financial interests, their swine, they drove him out of their region. Christ made no protest, he simply left. He left the opposite shore of the Sea of Tiberias and crossed over to this side, to what was called his own city, Capernaum. That was his starting point, so to speak. He would set out from there. It was his base. You know, many people do not want Christ when their interests are affected, when the gospel and Christ call their way of life, their fleshly conduct, and their dealings to account. Yet Christ, you know, is the only one who never imposes himself upon anyone. When does he refrain from imposing himself? When Christ sees even the slightest cloud pass over people's faces, he departs. Christ desires a cheerful countenance. He desires to hear those words spoken on the road to Emmaus, "Stay with us, remain with us." If we give even the slightest indication that we are displeased by Christ's presence, by his law, or by his gospel, know that grace takes flight. It departs at once. Just as smoke drives bees from the hive, so a person's sullen countenance drives grace away. He left without saying a word to them, although they should have said, "Thank you and stay with us, because you have set us free. You have opened the road that this demon-possessed man had blocked, so that we could not pass." Nevertheless, he did not ask them why they were driving him away. He left, entered the boat, and crossed to the other side. Someone might say that he lost all those people. Had he behaved differently, had he not touched their interests or called them to account, they would have kept him among them. Christ is not seeking votes. Christ is not a politician. He is not concerned with what people will say or whether they want him or not. He gathers his things and leaves. We need him. He does not need us. We must understand this. Many people think they are doing Christ a favor by keeping his commandments, but it is for my own good that I keep the commandments. It is for my own good to keep the documents required of me by the tax office and by the law. Otherwise, I will be brought before the public prosecutor tomorrow. Something similar applies here as well. So Christ crossed over and came here to his own city. And this is precisely where the passage begins that I am going to read to you and explain as simply as I can. More specifically, it is found in the 8th chapter of Luke, from verse 40 onward. As I said, these Sundays are dedicated to Luke. Now when Jesus returned, the crowd welcomed him, for they were all waiting for him. Some sent him away, while others welcomed him. You see, the place did not remain empty for even a moment. If I leave my place vacant, someone else will take it. Christ will always have subjects. Christ will always have friends. Christ will always have servants, free servants. They are not servants in the sense of slavery, but servants who are free. Such servants he will always have. Among the people who were waiting for him and welcomed him, there was also, as the passage says, a ruler of the synagogue, someone foreign to the spirit of Christianity. And behold, there came a man named Jairus, who was a ruler of the synagogue. What are you doing here? You do not love Christ, you do not accept him, and for many centuries you have refused to accept Christ. So what are you doing here? He comes out of need, not out of love. He has a daughter, his only child, who is dying. Medicine has abandoned him, and so he comes out of need. And falling at the feet of Jesus, he begged him to come into his house, for he had an only daughter, about 12 years old, and she was dying. This was the need, the reason Christ received the ruler of the synagogue when he came to him. He did not go out to welcome Christ. He went to beg him because he was in need. And what did Christ do? I will come, he told him, and heal her. I myself will come and take care of the matter. Could he not have refused? He had every reason to refuse. Since Jairus had so little faith in him, why should he not refuse? Yet he did not refuse him, just as he does not refuse us. Most of us too go to Christ out of need. We do not go out of love, nor do we remain out of love, except for certain people who, no matter what happens to them, will never allow their love for Christ to diminish. Most of us come to him out of need. Think about how we behave when we sense that someone is approaching us because they need something from us, and how we behave when they approach us out of love. The one is very different from the other, but with Christ there is no such difference. I will come, he tells him, and I will take care of your problem for you. He did not ask him, is it far away? Nor did he ask, is there some means of transportation to get there? Neither did he make the excuse, you know, I am tired from the journey, could I perhaps come later? Nothing of the kind. I will come, he tells him. Do not worry. And just as he was, he set out for the man's house. Imagine such conduct. He did this not only because this was what he felt in his heart, but also to leave it as a commandment for us. To be a Christian means to place oneself at the service of another. A Christian who does not place himself at another person's service, both materially and spiritually, is not a Christian, even if he has many icons in his home, burns a great deal of incense, and makes many prostrations. The Christian must place himself at the service of another, not only when he is asked, but must himself seek out those in need, because many times a need is unspoken, a pain is silent, and a person's plight has no voice. We must seek them out, saying, My God, where can I be of help, so that your name may be glorified, and my fellow human being may find relief? We have not made this a firm conviction within ourselves. We are Christians on the surface, not Christians in the depths of our being. Therefore, anyone who does not place himself, his strength, his presence, and even his wallet at the service of others is not yet a Christian. Christ does not reject him, but do not be deceived. These are the distinguishing marks of a Christian. Here, then, he left us an example, as Peter says, leaving us an example that you should follow in his footsteps. As he lived and acted, so must we act in our own lives. It is true that we often place ourselves at the service of our relatives, but not the person beyond our family circle. Even though, as Christians, we are all related, whether or not we are also related by blood, we are spiritually related through the same baptismal font, which became the spiritual mother of us all, and we receive Holy Communion from the same breast of the Church, called the Holy Chalice. Is that person not also our brother? Is he not called our brother in Christ? Is there not also such a thing as a brother according to the flesh? There is a brother according to the flesh through father and mother, but there is also a brother in Christ. There is spiritual kinship, and there is kinship according to the flesh, and as greatly as the flesh differs from the spirit, so one kind of kinship differs from the other. Here then he left an example showing that a person should not look to his own interests, but to those of another love. It says, does not seek its own, my own comfort, my own ease, my own pocketbook, but the good of the other. A person who will not sacrifice himself out of love for another and in response to another's need should not expect sacrifice from God, for God gives according to how we give. In any case, I will come, he tells him, do not worry. And it says here that as Christ went, the crowds pressed around him. So many people surrounded him that he could not walk freely. Some went ahead of him, some followed behind, and others accompanied him on either side. And there was a woman who had suffered from a flow of blood for 12 years among that crowd. In other words, was a woman who also had a need. She had been bleeding for 12 years. She had spent her entire livelihood on physicians, yet no one had been able to heal her. She had sold everything she possessed for the sake of her health. But no one had managed to heal her or bring her relief. She came up behind him and touched the edge of his garment, and immediately her flow of blood stopped. This woman, too, had both faith and need. She believed in Christ, it seems, in a different way than the ruler of the synagogue did. It may be that she too was only a person driven by her own need. We don't know. With the ruler of the synagogue, it was only natural. You can see it clearly. It jumps right out at you as we say that he stood opposed to Christ, just like those other Jews. Christ was overturning such things, so the man's interests would have been threatened, and he might have found himself reduced to an ordinary layman the next morning. Naturally, he would not have wanted Christ. As for the woman, we do not know what sort of person she was. But we do know, and can see, that she approached Christ deliberately. She did not go before him or ask him for what she wanted. She went behind him and stole it from him. Now someone may ask, can God be robbed? God cannot be robbed. As God, he knew that she was there among the crowd, why she had come, and what she intended to do as she followed behind him looking for an opportunity. Here they shoved her. There they stepped on her. Elsewhere they pushed her aside, until at last she reached him and touched the edge of his garment with her finger. She too approached with deliberate care. Yet this woman's deliberation was filled with deep reverence. This is something women should take heed of, and we men as well, though of course in other circumstances. She knew, evidently from the law, that when a woman was bleeding, she was not to come into contact with holy things. She plainly regarded him as a pure person, a holy person. Yet her need compelled her to go. Within her there arose a conflict of duties. On the one hand, she was in desperate need. On the other, she feared that she would defile him. What was she to do? She had no more money with which to pay physicians. She had no more blood to surrender to her illness. What could she do? She was under the force of necessity, and so she devised a way to approach him without defiling him. That was under the Old Testament. Consider how much more carefully women ought to observe this under the New Testament. Yet many women do not take heed of it. They attend weddings and baptisms and enter the church while ritually unclean. Many times they even go to church and to the divine liturgy in that condition. I am deeply saddened because some spiritual fathers have not grasped this matter and explicitly permit women in such a condition to go into the narthex of the church. Is the narthex not part of the church? Is only the sanctuary the church, or only the nave? Is the narthex not part of the church? Was it not anointed with chrism at the consecration? Did the bishop not go and consecrate it? Is not the entire church building sanctified? They do not observe even this, although the fathers have given their judgment on the matter. But these spiritual fathers have not studied it as they should, and so they give permission. No. During those days you must be careful. On the 5th, 6th, 7th, or 8th day you will remain apart. You are not going to recover enough to go to church. Say your prayers at home. Say your prayers in your cell. You should not go to church. You should neither light a candle nor venerate an icon. You should not even light the vigil lamp in your home. You should not take the prosphora, nor should you bring the kaliva to church. Send them with someone else. Saint Nectarios of Aegina clearly possessed the gift of discernment. You see, whenever a woman, whether a young girl or an older lady, approached to kiss his hand, he would put his hand behind his back. He would not give it to her. He said nothing. But it was as though he were telling her, be careful. This is not only for you older women. You should also teach it to your children. There must be reverence for the church, because the greater the reverence, the more grace is given. A person must fear God, that is, reverence God and reverence the holy place. And then he will receive a great blessing from God. But if he tramples everything underfoot, saying, this is nothing, and that is nothing, then he should know that he will not receive grace from God, even if he asks for it. What was she seeking? This woman has left us a great lesson, but it passes unnoticed. The way she acted reveals it. She was driven by necessity, for the reasons I have already told you. She had been suffering for 12 years. She saw miracles and heard about the miracles Christ was performing. She said to herself, perhaps I too will receive something. But how could I go? And if I do not go, what will happen? And yet, Christ, in his providential condescension, made allowance for this woman's need. But Christ discerned her faith, discerned her fear of God, and saw how highly she regarded him and how careful she was toward him. She did not go directly to kiss his hand or take hold of him, nothing of the sort, because she knew the condition she was in. And this was not the condition women sometimes experience each month. Rather, she had been in a constant state of hemorrhaging for 12 years. Blood was flowing from her veins. It was not the unclean blood that accumulates in the body in preparation for conception, and if conception does not occur, is discharged as something impure, lifeless, and dead. It was clean arterial blood. She was paying for it with her very life, and she could have made that distinction. Yet the thought that it was blood, and that when a woman has a flow of blood, she should not go to church or approach anything holy, and so forth, this was what kept her away from Christ. But her need compelled her, and so she dared to do this. She touched the very edge of the hem of his garment. This detail is significant. The gospel says that she touched the edge of the hem of his garment. Yet Christ was present even there. This also provides an answer to certain men and women who want to take 5 kilos of the blessing of water from church in order to sanctify an entire barrel. They want the whole barrel for themselves, so that no one else can have any, and getting the agasmos turns into a marathon. Once the blessing of water has been celebrated in the church, how much do I need to drink? You can take the smallest amount and it will serve its purpose. You can add a little more water to it and it will still serve its purpose. Or when someone passes beside you, you can say, pour a little for me too, wish them many years and take it, and it will serve its purpose. There is no need to jostle or shove to get drenched or drench anyone else to complain or even to blaspheme, for, out of ignorance, people go so far as that. They do this out of ignorance. This woman did not embrace Christ or wrap him in her skirts. She merely touched the edge of the hem of his garment, and immediately the flow of blood stopped. If a drop of the agiasmos, too small for the human eye to see, were to fall into all the oceans, it would sanctify them in an instant. What do we imagine God to be? Is he a material thing? Is grace something material, so that, as with cooking, we need plenty of good ingredients to make the food turn out well? That is absurd. We must understand this. Many people likewise complain when receiving Holy Communion. He did not give me much, they say. He gave me so little that I could barely see it. But even if you can barely see it, even if you merely touch the communion spoon with your tongue, the whole of God is already within you. But we want to feel these things physically and satisfy demands that simply cannot be met. From one holy chalice, 200 or 300 portions must be given from one tiny lamb, yet sanctification still takes place. Or people complain about the antidoron, the blessed bread distributed after the divine liturgy. He did not give us very much. In sacred matters, such measurements do not apply. It is not a matter of needing a large quantity for it to work properly, as though the blessing of water had to be made stronger. No, she merely touched the edge of the hem of his garment, and immediately the flow stopped. At once she felt power upon her, as the gospel goes on to tell us. In any case, when this happened, Jesus said, "Who touched me? Who was it that laid a hand on me?" A strange thing to ask, isn't it? And when all denied it, Peter and those who were with him said, everyone said that no one had touched him, but here, in actual fact, taken literally, the question is not who touched him. As Peter goes on to say, here Peter says, Master, they're crushing you. They've flattened you, as we'd put it in our own everyday speech. They're trampling on you, and so on. And now you say, who touched me? Who laid a hand on me? What sort of strange question is that? But in this case, Christ is not asking who touched him merely in passing, by chance. He is asking who touched him deliberately, with intent, with deliberate purpose. Master, the crowds surround you and press upon you, and you say, who touched me? But Jesus said to Peter, someone touched me, for I perceive power going out from me. I am not speaking about you. I am not speaking about those who come casually, some who come to catch me in my words, some out of curiosity, and others, I suppose, out of gratitude because I healed them and they feel obliged. I am speaking about someone who came with full awareness and deliberately touched me. Someone touched me, for I perceive power going out from me. If I put my hand into an electric current, will there not be a discharge of electricity into me? There will be a discharge of electricity into me. So when I place myself in contact with Christ, should there not also be such a transmission, provided that I am receptive? For if I am like a wooden plank, the current will not pass into me, will it? If I am like a tent, it will not pass into me. But if I am living flesh as I am and a good conductor, the current will pass into me. There will be a discharge into me. So if a person goes to the church, approaches Christ, and stands in prayer before Christ as a vessel capable of receiving grace, he will receive grace. Is that not so? He will not receive grace if he goes to the church merely out of habit and stands in prayer merely out of habit, without living organically in faith and with full awareness. Thank you. When a person goes to the church, he must go with insistence, determination, and fervor. I am going to receive. Of course, in order to receive, one needs a vessel. Yet we never go to the church with a clean vessel in which to receive. Most of us are sinners. The proof is that we do not approach Holy Communion. The day before yesterday, on the first of the month, I saw 50 mothers and grandmothers bring their children forward to receive Holy Communion, but not one of those women received communion herself. Do you understand now where this is leading? Is it possible for God to show mercy to such a family when the parents remain far away, unclean, with no relationship to the church and no relationship to the Holy Chalice? It is not possible. Therefore, fervor and full awareness are needed. That is precisely what happens in this case. This woman teaches us that whenever we are about to approach the divine, especially in the church and in prayer, we must be mindful of the one to whom we are going. And when we do take into account whom we are going to, and before whom we are standing at that very hour, things change both for us and for him. He then stretches out his hands to give to us with all his love, and we, for our part, receive. For if this woman had not gone with that reckoning and with that reverence toward his person, surely Christ would not have felt that power had gone out from him, just as he felt nothing of the sort for the others who were treading on him, pushing him, and crushing against him. Do you grasp what this means? Do you understand? Peter was telling the truth. He says to him here, he says, Lord, they are pressing in on you and crushing you. Not simply pressing you, they are literally squeezing you flat. And now you ask me, who touched me? I am not talking about you. This is the question every person should put to himself on every feast day and every Sunday when he goes to the church. The person who stands in church to pray should ask this question, I wonder, did he notice me here when I came today? I wonder, did he see me here where I stood and prayed? Many of us would probably faint from fear. But we don't have that awareness inside us. That sense simply isn't there in us. Did you notice me, Lord, today when I came to church? My Panagia, my most holy Theotokos, did you see me today? My saint, today we celebrate your name here. This church bears your name. Did you notice me when I came to church with my little children, with my husband, with my wife, with my parents, or by myself? Did you notice me? Did you feel power go out from you? Because if no power went out from you, how could it have come to me? If it came to me, that means it went out from you. Did you feel anything? That is the question. The answer may well be, I did not even notice you enter, sit there, or leave. This is why there is no spiritual progress in us. We remain exactly the same. We are like horses tied to a mulberry tree, stamping in the same spot and gouging the earth beneath them. We are bound by sin and cannot bear any fruit. That is the reality. In any case, what follows from all this is that a person must approach the divine with full awareness and reverence. Whether he receives anything depends on that. The result was that the woman realized he had perceived her, and she began trembling like a fish taken out of the water because of two fears. First, that he would now rebuke her for having taken the healing secretly, and second, that he would take away the grace she had sought for 12 years. Do you understand the state this woman found herself in when she realized that he had perceived her? When the woman saw, the text says, that she was not hidden, that she had not escaped his notice, she came trembling and falling down before him, declared to him in the presence of all the people why she had touched him. Until then she had acted secretly, but now everything was brought into the open. She came and said in effect, "Do not hasten to accuse me or rebuke me. First hear why I did this." She began defending herself before he could even speak, without knowing, of course, what our Christ was going to say. Our Christ had said nothing of the kind. It was Satan who immediately went and whispered this to her in order to drive her to despair. "Now you will see what will happen to you because of what you have done." Satan is a sadist. He wants to punish the human person. He wants the human person always to live in trembling and fear on every side, and he hastened. The poor woman did not know that our Christ would not take the grace away from her. On the contrary, he would praise what she had done and present it as an example to the others, who come to church but receive nothing. They draw near to him, but they receive nothing. It makes no difference whether they come or not. Thank you. Do you rejoice when a church is consecrated, or when other churches are filled with worshipers? Do you rejoice when grace flows from the altar, from our Mother, the Most Holy Theotokos, from the saints, and from the relics of the saints? Do you rejoice? Does this make you glad? No, you are sorrowful. But Christ is saddened because we do not give him such joys. We prepare ourselves outwardly, looking at ourselves in the mirror from front and back. We change our clothes, even our underclothes, but within, in the soul, the part of us with which Christ is concerned, we make no preparation to receive him, to draw from Christ, so that we ourselves may be filled. We take a piece of dry antidoron, the blessed bread distributed after the divine liturgy, and leave, and we remain exactly the same, entirely unchanged. So, in the presence of all the people, she declared, "This is what had been happening to me. This is what I thought, and this is how I answered." And she also told them that she had been healed immediately. At once she felt that she was a different person. That is no small thing. When we are healed of an illness, a long time may pass before we recover our strength and realize that things have changed, but here it happened immediately, in a fraction of a second, as we were saying. It was a miracle. God intervened, and the illness stopped. Christ gives her courage, and she revives like a basil plant that has just been watered. Our Christ did not give the answer this poor woman expected. She thought he would rebuke her and take away the grace, because she had stolen it rather than asking for it. But Christ did exactly the opposite. He said to her, "Take heart, have courage." He tells her, "What are you afraid of? Things are not the way you think they are, and not the way the arch craftsman, the devil, is suggesting to you. The one is Christ, the other is the devil. There's no comparison." And he said to the woman, "Your faith has saved you. I didn't do it for you." Now that is humility. Not "I did it, but your faith has saved you." We, though, every so often, if we end up helping some fellow human being, we squeeze him dry for it, and we want him reminding us of it forever. "It's because of me you're standing. I'm the one who got your daughter married. That job you have, I gave it to you. The bread you eat, I'm the one who gives it to you." We say, I. He did nothing. He deserves no credit. We did everything. And if someone does 1,999 good things for us but fails to do one, we tear down all the rest. But here Christ says, in effect, "I do not want you to say anything about me. Your faith has saved you." In other words, if you were healed, you were healed on account of your faith. Our Christ puts things in their proper place. My beloved, however much people may praise the sun, it does not rise any higher, nor does its brightness change. And however much people may condemn it, the sun does not sink any lower, nor does its brightness change or grow dark. So it is with Christ. Christ has no need of human praise. In the same way, every Christian who has even a little grace within does not wait for thanks and compliments, or worry about what the newspapers will say and what the programs will write. nor does he care what the radio stations will say about him or his name. Indeed, he is distressed and saddened when he hears his name being discussed, because there is always the danger that he may be affected by conceit and lose his soul. But because we are hollow, we have nothing within us. That is precisely why we look to certificates, applause, congratulations, and the praise and thanks of the world. We are hollow, we have no substance, no weight. A person who has weight within himself, who lives in a relationship with Christ, never asks for such things. Indeed, as I said earlier, if he hears his own name being mentioned, he is grieved and immediately says within himself, "My Christ shelter me." But we have not advanced spiritually. That is precisely why we seek praise and want the congratulations and good wishes of the world. And we take offense at others if they fail to behave as we would like, all because of our vainglory. In any case, the conclusion is this. "Go in peace," he answered the blessed woman. "Go with God's blessing in the good health you now possess. I take nothing from you, nor do I rebuke you. On the contrary, I commend you." Christ tells her, "Because of this faith of yours, which will remain recorded for people to behold throughout the ages and to guide the way they live." So when we enter the Church of God and when we stand before our icon corner to pray, let us not imagine that we are visiting a relative's house. And let us not behave as though we were simply stepping out to the greengrocer, with one trouser leg pulled up and our jacket or cardigan hanging loosely from our shoulders, merely going to light a candle before the Most Holy Theotokos, and so on. For what we receive there will correspond to the reverence and purity we show. Otherwise, we receive nothing. We may even incur guilt for the irreverence we show toward the holy place we have entered. A person must keep many things in mind when approaching Christ, when approaching the divine. There was a man from Patras who has now fallen asleep in the Lord. Every 2 hours he would get up, even during the night, and pray. His clock kept going off again and again, every 2 hours. He would get up and dress, as we were saying. He put on his proper clothes, even his tie, and went to stand before the icon corner. He prayed for 15 or 20 minutes and then returned to bed. He never went there in his pajamas, and he never stood naked before the icon corner. Is that not so? When you go to meet a member of parliament, a director, a prime minister, a president, or a king, how do you present yourself? How do I go? How do we all go? We take every care, showing full respect and dignity toward the person before whom we are to appear. And here, how do we present ourselves? Or do we just come however we happen to be? How do we come to the table to eat at midday or in the evening? How? Just look at the ladies with their chests exposed. Just look at the young women with their... I had better not say it. And look at the rest of us, with our shirts unbuttoned and so on, wearing short-sleeved undershirts and shorts, with our filthy feet exposed. And where do we sit down to eat? At Christ's table. Of course, people do this when they never even raise their hand to make the sign of the cross, and therefore do not recognize that this table belongs to Christ, and that Christ is present just as he was at Emmaus. But I am speaking to Christians who believe. I am speaking to those who keep a vigil lamp, light a candle, and receive antidoron, the blessed bread distributed after liturgy. I am speaking to such people and saying that they must attend to this detail as well. Monks never come to the refectory, whatever work they may have been doing, without first dressing properly and putting on their monastic cap. They come to the refectory in formal monastic attire because it is to the refectory table that they are coming. Christ will come to the table to bless the meal at its beginning and again at its conclusion. Therefore, the person who sets the table before him must be properly prepared, both outwardly and inwardly. If a person thinks along these lines and isn't indifferent to the presence of Christ, they have a great deal to gain, both in this world and above all in the world to come. There is no fear of God in us. We have no reverence for God. We are not afraid of God. We take no account of him. We don't reckon with him at all. That is precisely why we do not see the results we could have, if only we paid attention to these small details that people consider insignificant. Once a month I go to Patras to speak. On Saturday evening before I go to speak in the hall, I consider it my duty to visit the patron saint of Petrus, Saint Andrew, make a prostration, and light a candle. I am always accompanied by a very perceptive Christian from Patras. He waits for me in the car. We go together to venerate the saint and then return to the hall. As soon as we arrive outside the Church of St. Andrew, he reaches into his pocket and gives me a candle. He always keeps pure beeswax candles at home and buys them beforehand. He does not wait until he reaches the church to buy candles made from tallow and whatever other fats happen to have been used. He still gives his drachma to support the church. He gives 5 drachmas, 10 drachmas, or whatever amount he chooses, but he does not take a candle there. He already has a candle in his pocket, a pure beeswax candle, which in fact I send him from Athens, and he lights one whenever he goes to church. He gives one to me as well. I do put my drachma, or whatever I have to offer, into St. Andrew's donation box, but when I go to venerate his holy head, I light that little pure beeswax candle. This makes a deep impression on me and reproaches me, because so often we pay no attention to such things. Someone may say, it is nothing. What difference does the candle make? I could use any other candle. But where am I taking it? I'm taking it to my God, so why should it not be pure? If I were buying my friend a shirt, would I not go and get it from Dragana or Lampropoulos? And it will be a fine one, and I will even go into debt to buy a shirt for my friend with whom I sin. What then should the thing I offer to my God be like? I am giving you just one small example, how discerning and careful we must be if we truly want good results. Prayer, prayer, prayer. Neither the speaker, nor the chanter, nor the sacristan, nor the parish committee at the back, nor the charitable societies, nor those who went inside, no one goes. The divine cannot be forced, my dear friends. Keep that firmly in mind. Grace cannot be commanded. Pay no attention to how the others approach. How will you and I approach? How will we enter the church? How will I go to the church? Where will I stand? How will I respond? Where will I direct my gaze, and how will I use my eyes? How will I manage to unite myself with him and ask for forgiveness and mercy? What the others may do is not my concern. If everyone did this, things would be different. Even if they did not become different for others, they would be different for us personally. Christ reverences, watches over, shelters, answers, protects, and guides those who are his own. Those who fear God, reverence God, and take God seriously, as that poor woman did. He does everything for them, because he regards them as his own. But with others who show such indifference, he cannot act in the same way. We bind his hands. We ourselves do not allow him to bless us. In any event, that woman received his blessing. Go in peace. May God say that to you at the moment you leave for your family, for your little ones, for home. He will say it to you. He blesses you from behind, unseen, with his hand. And he says, go with God's blessing. Go with my blessing. He will set everything in order for you. Everything. Sunday, for example, is the first day of the week. Monday is the second day, as its Greek name itself tells us. On the first day of the week, you go and receive God's blessing for the whole week ahead. This is a great thing. But aren't we losing the grace of that blessing because we don't give Christ the room to give us the blessing? In any case, in all this time that we've been sitting here discussing these things, the girl has died at home, and the girl died at home because, as we were saying, along came this woman, I don't know, this old woman, that wretched old woman, her family or the others would have called her, and she held the doctor up. Why did she have to appear just then? If she had not delayed the physician, he would have reached the child while she was still alive. But because of all this commotion, the teaching and everything else, Christ did not reach the house in time, and so the girl died. Can you imagine what a storm of logismoi, the intrusive thoughts stirred up by the devil, must have assailed the ruler of the synagogue while Christ was being delayed by this woman in the midst of the crowd? Why did she have to appear now? He could have thought 1,000 such things. We ourselves sometimes speak in exactly this way. In many situations we become indignant, hurl insults, and even utter curses. But listen to how the Gospel puts it. While he was still speaking, Christ was still answering the woman at that very moment, telling her, "Go in peace," and so forth. Someone came from the ruler of the synagogue's house and said to him, "Your daughter is dead. Do not trouble the teacher. Do not weary him. There is no need," he tells him. The matter is over. It would have been well if he had found her alive. But now this old woman appeared in his path and caused this delay. What can be done? Do not trouble him. Let him go about his work. That is what he said before the ruler of the synagogue could even speak or begin to weep or whatever he might have done. Our Christ hastened to reassure him. But when Jesus heard it, he answered him, saying, "Do not fear, only believe, and she will be saved. You must go on believing as you believed when you set aside your position as ruler of the synagogue." For it was no small thing for the ruler of the synagogue to go and fall at the feet of the one they called a Samaritan and said had a demon. It was a great thing indeed the others could see him. You, the ruler of the synagogue, falling at the feet of the Nazarene. Who has ever heard of such a thing? Do you understand, as you believed before, Christ tells him, continue to believe? That is why we keep saying to you, "But she has died. Come now, what does that matter to you?" So she died. There was a beautiful exchange of words in a parallel case, you will remember it, between the sister of Lazarus and Christ, about the matter of Lazarus. She says, "Lord, by now there is a stench, for he has been dead 4 days. Do not say another word." "He smells," she says, "he has been dead 4 days. Did I not tell you you believe? Did I not tell you to believe? I know," she says, "that he will rise again in the resurrection. I am the resurrection. So long as Christ is with us, my beloved, even if we were to enter hell, it would immediately become paradise. The presence of Christ, the presence of grace, changes the whole appearance of things." Death. We have nothing we consider more serious, and yet he now tells him, "You only believe, and she will be saved. Your trouble will be resolved. But she has died. Nothing could be worse. And yet there is something worse, for Christ not to be there." When Christ is present, and here Christ is indeed present, everything is set right. That is why a person who believes looks upon everything with such calm detachment that others think him mad. My brother, who was a general, called me mad because I did not weep at my mother's funeral. Do you understand that is how people see things when they do not have grace, when they do not have those spectacles Christ gives us, so that we may see reality as it truly is? Of course, this is how you will think and how you will feel. The world knows nothing of these things. Whatever may happen, let only sin not be involved. Sin is the truly sorrowful thing. Everything else can be set right. But the world cannot understand this. If you wish to verify what I'm telling you, read the 11th chapter of the Epistle to the Hebrews. There Paul speaks of the ways in which various prophets and spiritual strugglers of the Old Testament endured their contests. They were sawn in two, he says. They were tortured. They were sewn into goatskins, placed beneath the sun, and left to dry up and die. They were slain with the sword. They wandered in deserts and on mountains, in caves, and in the holes of the ground. And there in a parenthesis, he says, of whom the world was not worthy. The world isn't worthy of such people. These are serious things indeed. These are serious, exceedingly serious matters. Yet we may consider it a great thing when some actress achieves something, or when someone has some other success, wins the football pools, builds something impressive, or anything of that sort. Compared to God, and to life, and to a person's whole existence in this world, those things are a joke. The world is not worthy, as Scripture says, of such things. So don't let this seem strange to you. You, he tells him, you just believe. And I want us to know that God has two hands. Let's not turn God into a one-armed God. He died. God took him from me. But God has another hand as well, a hand to give you comfort. With the one he takes away, and with the other he holds you steady. The question is, do you trust him, or do you run off to a medium to sort your problem out? Or do you turn the pictures on the wall upside down to drive death away? Do you believe in Christ, or do you not? That is the question. For it is true that with one hand Christ takes away, but with the other he gives and supports us. That is why I say that Christians who are supported by Christ, who hold fast to Christ and make everything depend upon Christ, can look upon all these things with great calmness, for to me to live is Christ and to die is gain. It is nothing, in truth, death is almost laughable, especially for the Christian. It is a small episode with a little crack. The shell called the body breaks and remains below, while the little bird flies away and ascends. What could be more beautiful? Ask the little chicks. At first they do not want to come out. They sit cramped inside the shell. Their mother calls from outside, "Do you want to come out?" "No, no, no." Then she stops asking, and suddenly a little beak pokes through. "What a fool I was," the chick says afterward. "I sat there all shriveled up, while out here there is sunshine, food, worms, and all manner of good things. And I was sitting shut up in there." In exactly the same way, when we die, we shall pity ourselves, and they will tell us to return because we left behind orphans, a widower or a widow, or other dear ones in the world. And we shall not return. That is how absurd it is. Yet we do not think of it in this way. In any case, our Christ is the one who can comfort a person, and he does so lest Satan then cast him down and make him turn against the woman who had caused the delay. The physician had been delayed, for they regarded Christ as a man. They did not regard him as God. That is why the man said, "Do not trouble the teacher." The teacher might be able to work miracles, but now the girl was dead, and there was nothing more he could do. Do you understand? In any case, when Jesus heard this, he answered him, saying, "Do not be afraid, only believe, and she will be saved." They continued on in silence, and Jairus followed with his head bowed. When he came to the house, he allowed no one from the crowd accompanying him to enter. He allowed in only Peter, John, and James, together with the child's father and mother. He let five people enter. The first three were the foremost apostles, as we have said. He always performed his miracles before them. This was so that what we say might be fulfilled. By the mouth of two or three witnesses every word shall be established. And he allowed her parents to remain as well. They were all weeping and beating their breasts for her, lamentation and mourning. You know what it is like, especially when a young man or woman dies. The wedding sweets are still there, the candles are still there, and all the rest. We did not even have time to eat the wedding sweets, and the dowry has been left behind, all the usual things we say. She was 12 years old, their only daughter. Think of the dreams her parents must have had. Now they had lost her. They wept for her and beat their breasts in lamentation and wailing, as we have said. But he said, "Do not weep. Do not carry on like this. How can we not weep? Our daughter has died. She has not died. Then what is she doing? She is sleeping. Remember that. She is asleep. We call them cemeteries for the dead, but in truth they are places of rest, cemeteries, not places of death. And the church does not pray for the dead, but for those who have fallen asleep. Just as a person sleeps and wakes up, so it is with them. Even if someone has died, that person will awaken one day. Just as the alarm clock rings and we wake up, so in exactly the same way, one day the angel's trumpet will sound and we shall rise again. We call ourselves Christians, yet we do not believe in the resurrection. If we do not believe in the resurrection, then what kind of Christians are we? St. Paul says that we are the most pitiable of all people. In the 15th chapter of 1 Corinthians, he says that this is so if a person believes in Christ only for this world and not for the world to come. She is sleeping. And they laughed at him. Each one shook his head as if to say, "What is he talking about?" They knew that she had died. They had probably already prepared and adorned her body, as we say. But he put them all outside, took her by the hand, and called out, saying, "Child, arise." He put outside all those who doubted the resurrection. The passage does not say whether her parents doubted the resurrection. The others, however, did doubt the resurrection. They did not believe that she was sleeping and that he would awaken her. He took her by the hand and said, "Child, my girl, arise, get up," he commanded her. He did not offer supplication as Elijah did, or Elisha or Peter when he raised Tabitha, and so forth. Christ himself is life. He himself is God, the Prince of life, the Lord who has authority over life, and here he commands death itself. And so he says, "Arise," and her spirit returned, and she arose immediately. Metempsychosis, reincarnation, that's what they tell us. Where had the spirit gone in the meantime? Had some little donkey been born somewhere, and the spirit went into it? Some little kitten, and now the little donkey and the little kitten have dropped dead? And so the spirit came back, or had they put the spirit in a bottle? And were they keeping it there until Christ came to take it and put it back in her? How laughable they are, how inconsistent, not to say how ridiculous, the people who believe in reincarnation, and her spirit returned. Her spirit returned, and she arose immediately. The spirit does not die, the soul does not die, she arose at once, and he commanded that she be given something to eat, so that they could see that she was not a vampire, a phantom, or some kind of spirit. She is truly flesh and blood, and her parents were astonished. But he instructed them to tell no one what had happened. "Please," he says, "do not tell anyone. There is no need. It is not good for people to hear about it. Should it become known through me, let them not be told. It will become known on its own. For a person's deeds are what speak aloud on that person's behalf. The point is not to speak without acting. Let us act without speaking. And our deeds themselves will speak for us. These are the lessons that flow from the two miracles Christ performed. Hold on to whatever you judge helpful and whatever you're able to retain, because we need these things, especially in our own days, for we are not Christians as we ought to be.